Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Remind you, as we start our conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are going to start our program off with folks who are down in Cancun, Mexico. They're not vacationing. They're actually working for the future of our planet down there. We're going to be joined for the next half hour by Janet Redman, who is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies, and shortly by Melina Labocan-Massino, who is a member of the Indigenous Environmental Network's delegation to the Climate Change Conference in Cancun, and a Lubicon Cree from Northern Alberta, Canada. And Janet Redman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Good. Glad you could find a landline to join us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let's talk about this conference for a moment. What's interesting to me is that there has not been a huge amount of coverage of this conference, either in terms of what's going on inside the building or what's going on the street. So first, just let our listeners know what's going on, what this conference is, and what you all are doing there.
Sure. So this conference is the UN convention, the climate convention, meets every year. This is the place where countries from 192, governments from 192 countries gather to make decisions basically about a climate deal. What's on the table right now is the second commitment here to the Kyoto Protocol. I think a lot of people recognize the name Kyoto Protocol. It's the one treaty we have on the planet to keep greenhouse gas emissions at a level that keeps the planet and people on the planet safe. What's happening is that it expires next year, just in terms of its next commitment period. So what has to be decided here is to say yes to a second commitment period, and for the developed countries, the rich nations who have been most responsible for creating the climate crisis, to put their legally binding emissions targets on the table, come up with an aggregate target that will keep the planet into safe levels of warming, and then to divide that up equitably between the rich countries of the world. But the risk, of course, is for the Kyoto Protocol to die, and that's what the U.S. would like to happen, Canada would like that to happen, Japan and others. What happens if the Kyoto Protocol dies is that there's no overall target for a greenhouse gas emissions cap. That means that people can put pledges on the table if it adds up to whatever it adds up to, so it goes. It's not legally binding, so you just review it in a couple years, and if you don't make your pledge, nothing really happens. So it really means that the fate of the planet is at stake right now, and we have to get a second commitment period to the Kyoto Protocol.
Now, did you just say that the United States and other major countries want the Kyoto Protocol to expire?
Yeah, they'd really like it to die. I mean, so this next commitment period, the one we signed right now, it ends in 2012. The U.S. never signed up to that, but there is pressure for the U.S. to do something comparable. And in fact, a whole other track of negotiations has opened up where the U.S. could put its binding emissions targets. President Obama, of course, we don't have a cap-and-trade policy in the U.S., but President Obama has said that he wants to make the 4% emissions reductions from the 1990 levels by 2020. That's a pittance compared to what other developed countries have said they would do. But even that has been challenging to get the U.S. to do. They don't want to set the Kyoto Protocol, never will. But countries here, especially countries from the developing world, are saying, well, at least put your commitment somewhere. Put them in this other track so that we can have some effort from the United States. They're also saying, actually, maybe we shouldn't worry about the U.S. coming into the Kyoto Protocol because they just dragged down the process. They basically lower the common denominator and make the Kyoto Protocol weaker than it would be. So we're saying developed countries of the world, sign up for the next commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. U.S., take comparable emissions targets through this other track called the Track for Long-Term Cooperative Action. And when that happens, and when those countries can provide the kinds of money that's needed by developing countries to lower their emissions, that's what's going to happen. Under the LCA track, with the finance made available by the rich countries, developing countries have said, we'll put some targets on the table as well. We'll meet you halfway.
So how is what's happening in Cancun, before we jump into what you all are doing there on the inside and outside of this conference, how is it different than what went on in Copenhagen?
I think it's different in a lot of ways. One, there's been a real push to lower expectations here, both in the government, the environmental community, some civil society communities. Basically, people said, this isn't going to be a big moment like Copenhagen. Don't wish for a whole heck of a lot. And so it's been pretty quiet here. It's been quiet in terms of civil society participation. There are fewer people here. But also the secretariat, the folks who run the conference, have really, really shut down civil society space. So even the folks that have managed to make it here and have managed to get accredited and, you know, travel an hour in the bus every single day to get here and travel another half an hour to get to the actual negotiations after that, they're finding that they're being refused to do actions here in the civil society spaces and in the negotiating spaces. So we've seen it from last year, the really shutting down of public voice and public opinion.
So that's interesting, I mean, because one would think that the United Nations would be the place that would not happen.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, what we saw last year, of course, was that civil society was really able to name and shame a lot of countries. I think countries would come back and said, we'd rather do this behind closed doors. And the fact that UNFCCC Secretariat this year is Mexico. Mexico's hosting the talks. They've been doing a number of things to kind of that makes civil society very concerned that this is kind of a Copenhagen too. They've been holding a series of what we call in the WTO trade negotiations green rooms. That means that they do invite-only small group consultations to get the people they want in the room. It's been advertised that, you know, we need a small group to talk to each other because in a big group we don't come to understanding. So these small groups can be very valuable spaces. Unfortunately, what happens in these small rooms, what developing countries have expressed concerns about, is that in a small room, those who are least powerful can be bullied by those who are most powerful. And in fact, we're nervous about this, and developing countries are nervous about this, because we've actually seen evidence of that kind of bullying and bribery if we just look at the WikiLeaks. In the WikiLeaks, we saw that the U.S. had talked to many countries, including China, to say, you know, we need to put pressure on Bolivia to stop blocking the process of getting an accord in Copenhagen. Since then, we've seen that the U.S. has basically traded aid for support with Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has come on board saying they want the Copenhagen outcome to stand here in Cancun. We've also seen Kenya shift, and it just so happens that this morning Kenya and France are announcing a new finance mechanism together. So the idea of having these small spaces that are quieter but that are kind of behind the scenes really concern us, because it means that the process has become very untransparent, and countries are much more exposed to the kinds of bullying and pressure tactics that mean they have to compromise the fate of their own people.
And you're saying that and that's running rampant there, despite the WikiLeaks that have exposed what happened in Copenhagen.
Absolutely. I mean, the WikiLeaks have really helped open the conversation here. And the government has moved to a new process called Green Men. So it's like a mobile green room where a developed and developing country contact point are given an issue to work on. For example, for finance, it's Australia and Bangladesh. And those two people walk around and have consultations with the countries they feel are most important on that issue. So what that means is there's no place for everyone to get together to talk about it. There is a finance contact group, which is where people are supposed to be negotiating over the text. But as well, there are these small conversations happening where, you know, countries pick and choose who they want to consult with to come up with a final document. And so the real concern is we're having basically a Copenhagen 2 here in Cancun, where when the high-level ministers and heads of state show up at the end of this week, there'll be a text on the table that's terrible for developing countries. But if anyone says no to that text, they'll be vilified, as Bolivia was last year.
This is, it's interesting that, as I said in the beginning of this program, that there's not been much coverage. I mean, when I went to New York Times before I went on the air and some other newspapers and kind of just did a search on COP16, very little came up of substance. Go ahead.
No, I think part of the problem is that, you know, press is having a hard time accessing the real conversations as much as civil society is, so it's hard to do coverage. And then, of course, in the U.S., I think we're in a political moment where there's kind of, you know, there's a letdown after last year's, the failure of this year's cap and trade scheme, the elections that have really seen a huge amount of climate deniers enter the House, enter our own government. I think people are a bit demoralized by covering this issue, and I think folks have lowered expectations so far that they figure, why even bother looking at Cancun? There is a sense that next year the big deal will happen when everyone meets in South Africa for the UN Climate Summit in December of 2011. And, you know, there's hope that that will draw some attention next year, but I think Copenhagen was such a disappointment for so many people that it's challenging to get people to look at this issue right now.
We're talking with Janet Redmond. She's co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., talking to her from Cancun, Mexico, where she is on the outside here at COP16, and we're talking as well. We've just been joined by Melina Lubicon-Massimo, who is a member of the Indigenous Environmental Network delegation to the Climate Change Conference in Cancun and a member of the Lubicon Cree from northern Alberta, Canada. And Melina, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you both this question. I'll start with you, Melina, and that this is something that I think that is really fascinating and very important, that whether you look at Copenhagen or what is happening now at this international conference in Cancun on the outside of these gates, or what you're seeing, what you saw in Cochabamba, Bolivia, at the conference there that was called by the Bolivian government there, is that especially in these two conferences, this is being led in large part by grassroots people, by communities of color from across the globe, by indigenous people. Something is bubbling up, and which I think is a significant change in what's happening in this movement to save the planet. Melina?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the fact that it's even funny, because I don't think a lot of people realize that the Cochabamba text actually has been removed from the negotiating text here in Cancun. And that's been pretty upsetting and pretty disappointing for a lot of people that have, you know, went to Bolivia at the time. And over 35,000 people attended that conference in Cochabamba, and, you know, representing over 40 different governments, to provide a path forward, you know, and also provide critical solutions, especially people from the front lines and, you know, from fossil fuel-based economies where they're experiencing detrimental effects already from these resources that are coming from these communities, as well as, you know, on the front lines of climate change. And yet this text, which was a declaration that was put out by all of these people that attended that conference, is not even included in a conference like the UN where, you know, we need to see real solutions to deal with climate change.
Would you talk a bit about what both of you for a moment, starting with Melina and then go to Janet, what these Cochabamba protocols were, what they said, and why they're being rejected by this international United Nations conference? Melina?
So basically what they were was respecting the rights of indigenous peoples as well, and then but also respecting the rights of Mother Earth. And a lot of this also excluded market-based mechanisms where, you know, a lot of corporations and you know, the Wall Street speculators are trying to basically get in on the carbon markets of selling the air and selling forests to supposedly, quote-unquote, save the climate. When we know that is actually just continuing to allow them to develop and have increasingly have sources of emissions coming from this source, and not actually dealing with the issues of climate change, which is needing to keep it in the ground, needing to respect the people that live in these forests, where basically it's selling off forests. So there's a lot of problems associated with spread, associated with market-based mechanisms, which aren't actually a solution. It's a false solution that's been proposed by, you know, the carbon market. And so this basically what we're hoping is that what the Cochabamba Declaration was pushing for, rights of people, human rights, as well as pushing for rights of humans, of Mother Earth, and pushing for rights of and respect for indigenous peoples as well.
Janet Redmond, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Melina said it really well. And, you know, the Cochabamba Accord embodies a lot of the most important issues for civil society, for the planet, and it embodies, you know, really relevant ideas and issues for the negotiations. Some of the things that we've worked hard on are the financing mechanism, the call for the World Bank to get out of climate finance, the call for 6% of GDP to be transferred from rich countries to those who are most impacted by climate change, which is about the amount that rich countries actually spend on their military budgets every year. It called for getting the carbon market out of the climate change conversation, which is critical. You know, as Lord Stern, who's with his groundbreaking research on the economics of climate change, said, climate change is actually the world's largest market failure. And so the idea that we're using carbon trading and carbon markets and offsets as a way to solve the climate crisis, both as a way to reduce emissions, which is a false solution, and as a way to transfer resources from north to south, is really leading us down the path of destruction in terms of the climate, and inaction from wealthy countries in particular. I think that one of the most important pieces, though, is that the UN is the one multilateral space where all countries have an equal voice, and the one chance that civil society has in the multilateral format to influence our own governments and to influence global decision-making. So when something like the Cochabamba quote, which is absolutely unprecedented, is rejected by governments here, and particularly by pressure from those rich northern governments that have been holding this up financially and ecologically for decades and really centuries, it's really upsetting. It's really upsetting both civil society and to developing countries themselves.
It feels to me, when I read what's going on there, Malina, that this is it's almost the things that the Cochabamba Accords, the indigenous people, the Via Campesina, the group of worldwide group of farmers from all over the globe who are fighting to maintain their farms and to save this planet, are being dismissed as irrelevant. That they're unimportant. It's almost like men dismissing women. I mean,
sorry.
Go ahead, Malina. Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I did you want to finish your question?
It was a statement question. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's true. And that's very frustrating when a lot of people, you know, dedicate their time and energy to come to conferences like this and try to, you know, and dedicate their time and energy and travel all the way to places like Bolivia where they're trying to make a difference. And yet, you know, governments of the world continually and fundamentally lead people out of the process, disrespect human rights, all for, you know, a lot of times it's for the profit of corporations a lot of times, and fossil fuel, continuing down this path of fossil fuel-based paradigm in a time in this, you know, of our history where we need to deal with climate change and real solutions to actually deal with, you know, the rising sea levels, to the erratic behavior, changing weather patterns. It's, you know, it's very problematic, and we're seeing this from a variety, and hearing this from a variety of different people, that whether it be that are far north or, you know, in small island states, people are being impacted. You know, I think a lot of us already know that 300,000 people every year die from climate change. A million more are made climate refugees. And yet, you know, governments of the world dismiss this and don't actually take this into account and actually represent people that they should be representing and actually protecting, you know, their quote-unquote citizens. So this is very problematic and it's very frustrating. But, you know, what we're seeing on the outside at the same time is that thousands of people, say, for instance, yesterday marched on the streets of Cancun. We marched just, you know, less than 2 miles up to the Moon Palace to demand, you know, to show that we're all in solidarity and we're working together, whether it be through the Indigenous Environmental Network, working with Bolivian government representatives, working with La Via Campesina. There's a variety of different social movements that are working together to say, you know, time. This is, you know, we're running out of time, and enough is enough. We need to actually start to have real solutions, and we need to start listening to people that are being impacted by climate change.
Watching those demonstrations yesterday, which I saw on Democracy Now! And on the web, because you didn't see them on the major news stories anywhere. Major stations around this country, or the ones I've been looking around Europe, you did not see them covered in an extensive way. Again, these were demonstrations that were led by communities of color, by indigenous people, by young people from across the globe. I mean, this is a movement that is really unprecedented. And I wonder if you could talk just for a minute, both of you, for a second. Jen, you have to go in a few minutes. Do I understand that?
Yeah, but take your time.
Okay, because we got about 8 minutes left in this segment. Talk a bit about the Indigenous Environmental Network. Talk a bit about Via Campesina, who these organizations are and what they're fighting for our listeners who've maybe never heard of either one.
For sure. Well, the Indigenous Environmental Network is a network, you know, that's been around for 20 years and has been a part of the inside UN process, but has also been on the front lines with, you know, a lot of the staff is from frontline communities. I myself am from a frontline community. I'm impacted by the tar sands project in northern Alberta. So, you know, it's a network of Indigenous peoples that are working for environmental justice. And so that's Indigenous Environmental Network is just, you know, working together from a variety of different, you know, we're dealing with a lot of fossil-based issues within our communities, but yet we're trying to figure out strategic ways to deal with this on an international level, a national level, you know, and a binational level. So that's the IEN in a nutshell. And La Via Campesina is, you know, an even larger network. It's an international movement that is, you know, accumulates all the different farmers and small peasant workers that are that have their own small farms with, around the world. So, you know, it's this huge network that, you know, people are working hand in hand now together because they see that, you know, I think people have always wanted to work together, but now, it's, you know, we're forced to try to make alliances across the globe to be able to address this issue of climate change because it's, you know, the issue of our time.
And Jen, let me lead you off with this question and then go to Melina. I listened to Amy Goodman interview Bill McKibben the other day on Democracy Now, who just left the conference to go to New York to get the Nation Puffin Award. And I've never heard him quite like this. He was almost depressed in some ways listening to him talk. But he said it half a dozen times during the interview. He said, this is the question of power. We are struggling to fight to save the earth, but the power of coal, oil, gas, and large and big capital are winning this battle, and we don't know if we're going to win. I've never heard him say that before in that way. And I wonder what the two of you, starting with Janet Redmond, then go to Melina Lubakan-Massimo, think about that and think about where we are in this struggle with the power of the corporate world and our earth. Where do you think we are, Janet?
Well, I think we're in a terrible spot. I mean, in some ways, you know, I think that the financial crisis has helped people recognize the fact that corporate power is still well and alive, particularly in the U.S., where, you know, besides the fact that we had a groundbreaking number of people calling in during the bailout saying, don't bail the large banks out, you know, the government went ahead and bailed the banks out anyway. So we're at a time when I think we need to recognize the fact that corporate power is still strong. Here in the UN climate talks, we see it in a lot of ways. And we see it in some cases with NGOs who decided to work with corporations like Coca-Cola to talk about the impacts of climate change on water scarcity. That's incredibly ironic because, of course, Coke is one of the violators of water rights around the world. But you also see it, I think, in some really interesting places inside the negotiations. There are business members that are part of government delegations. There's a proposal right now to create a civil society liaison table, one for business NGOs, the rest for these six remaining constituencies on the planet. And then you've got the International Emissions Trading Association, the Global Carbon Trading Lobbying Association, here an incredible force, and holding entire suites of side events and working with governments, working with NGOs, working with just about everyone to have their positions heard. Here in the negotiations and in governments back at home as well.
Melina?
It is a sign of the changing times. It's a unsettling feeling that, you know, no matter how hard that we do, sometimes these corporations and, you know, complicit governments work hand in hand, and it seems to, you know, to our demise of humanity, and that's just, you know, it's hard to understand a lot of times. And you know, as a young person, especially when I was younger, I used to think, you know, a lot of the UN. I used to think, you know, like, wow, one day I'd love to work for the UN. But now it's, you know, being a part of these negotiations and seeing, you know, what's going on, hearing about backroom deals, hearing about, you know, how the UN is being co-opted and corrupted by carbon traders. And you know, it's basically the current trajectory of the UN is not going to save the planet. And, you know, ultimately, I think that, you know, that's what we would like to think. But, you know, we see that these negotiations are faltering. And, you know, we don't really see much coming out of it here at COP16, maybe COP17. But, you know, it's really hard to have trust and faith in that process when we don't see, you know, anything real coming out of it, any sort of real solution. And ultimately, you know, the Earth is sick. Mother Earth is sick. And there's been a lot of, you know, violations towards the way that we've been treating the planet. And, you know, we can only keep living this way for so long. And I think a lot of us already know that. But it's just, doesn't seem to be reaching the ears of, you know, the governments that are put in place by the people to be able to deal with this issue at large. So I think, you know, it's a little bit sad sometimes, but it's also it's good to be here and trying to continually push the envelope and, you know, march with thousands of people and continue to push and show that people are still watching the world governments and still watching the UN and trying to keep them, you know, on check.
I think it actually is a very inspiring thing from watching 100,000 people in Copenhagen and what's happened here, that this internationalization of a movement led by communities of color and women is really a major shift in the politics and social movements of the world, which I think is that the mainstream media does its best not to kind of cover.
Right.
It's almost too frightening for some folks to behold that actually is happening. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. What happens over the next couple of days? Melita and then Jana, what's going to happen to the conference from your perspective on the outside, and what are you going to be doing?
Well, I could jump in. I'm on the inside, so I think we're going to see happening on the inside here is incredible pressure on the AFTER group. We've already seen Ethiopia undermining the power of the Democratic Republic of Congo to hold the position that says no to the Copenhagen Accord. So that undermining is already being done by Meles, and Meles is starting to fold, and we see the influence of Japan in a statement they made last night by mistake that said that they want the end of their second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, and then retracted that statement and said that was the wrong draft that they had read out loud. I think we're going to continue to see the vilification of Bolivia and countries in the ALBA group like Nicaragua and Paraguay who speak out and say we can't have a bad deal. We either have to have nothing here or something good here. But let's not undercut the fate of the people of the planet, not undercut the rights of Mother Earth and here in Cancun. So I think we'll see increased pressure on those who speak out and those who agree for the rights of people on the planet. And the continuation from the UN, the EU to push carbon markets, Canada, Japan, and Russia to allow those markets to go haywire, where they just shouldn't be at all on the planet, and forests and eventually water biodiversity are going to play a part in that as well. So I think we're heading down a track of some really perilous perilous future here in Cancun in the next few days.
Melina Lubicon-Massimo, closing thought.
We'll still be here continuing to put pressure on the UN, both on the inside and outside. Our delegates are both on the inside and outside. And, continuing to, build alliances and support Bolivia and the Cochabamba Accord, and also put pressure on governments, like the Canada, Japan, and Russia that are trying to not go through with their commitments to Kyoto Protocol. They're trying to kill Kyoto Protocol. So, following these outcomes of the negotiations and continue to, back in our respective countries, continue to deal with our respective governments and continue to put pressure on them and hopefully for real solutions in the future.
Melina Lubicon-Massimo from the Indigenous Environmental Network and Jana Redmond from the Institute for Policy Studies in Cancun, thank you both so much for joining us, and good luck, and we look forward to talking to you both again.
Thanks so much for having the fun.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
We can take a very brief break and come back. On the way there, let me remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Chef Max Louisiana Cuisine. Catering available for all holiday parties and special occasions. Open Monday through Thursday, noon to 8 p.m., and Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 9 p.m., located at 4311 Hartford Road. For more information, 410-319-6227. That's 410-319-6227. We'll be right back. Stay with us.